For 20 years, Small Business Digest has helped millions of entrepreneurs grow their business. We do this by highlighting ways they can increase profits. Whether these suggestions improve marketing and provide better financial management, offer robust people management ideas, provide speedier logistics, our guests each offer ways of reducing costs, adding sales, widening profits. I'm Don Mazzella, the program is Small Business Digest, and our next guest is Marcos Jacobus. It's an interesting name. There's a lot more to him. It's probably one of the most interesting guests we've had in a long time. Marcos, welcome to the program.
Well, thanks very much for the opportunity to be at your show, Don.
Well, first off, tell us a little bit about your background before we do anything else.
First of all, I have a very difficult last name to pronounce. Pronounce my last name in different ways. So it's Marcos Jacober. And as you can see, based on my accent, I'm not from the United States. You know, I'm from Brazil. I grew up in Brazil. And although I'm a Brazilian, my life wasn't always a carnival. And I migrated to the United States in 1998 with $100 in my pocket in pursuit of the American dream.
Well, I gather that you've succeeded far beyond your anyone's expectations. But you came here, you came with $100, and now what are you doing now?
Okay, so when I arrived in the United States, I had all kinds of odd jobs, right? I work in the construction, I work in a restaurant, I did all kinds of odd jobs. And I realized that real estate is one of the best ways for you to become a millionaire. So I jumped on a real estate wagon, and I started doing real estate in early 2000s. And I lost everything in 2007. Drove a truck for a company called FEDEX. You probably heard of them. And drove a FedEx truck for 14 years. Then I got back into real estate doing text means and text deeds, and I fell in love with the share economy, and I believe that's what we're going to talk today about, share economy and the Generation Z, and how the share economy is transforming the small business landscape, and how now I believe, and I got to tell you for sure, for those folks that are listening and believe that the American dream is dead, now has never been the best time. Now is the best time, fantastic time, to conquer the American dream.
Well, but let's back up a little bit. What do you mean by the shared economy?
Okay, well, shared economy is the new trend. People are talking about and considering the shared economy. Economists, politicians, all spectrum of PhDs out there, consider the share economy as the third revolution. We have the agricultural revolution, then you have the industrial revolution, and now we are entering the third revolution about share economy. And that's they expect by 2021 we're going to have at least 45% of the workforce dealing with the share economy or producing any kind of income from the share economy. And you probably know share economy as Airbnbs, as Turo, as Uber, and those are the big players out there. But definitely nowadays we have more than 100 different ways to produce income into work and make a living that comes from the share economy.
But that being the case, you have an unusual approach. Tell us about your approach.
Okay, so I don't like to say it is a new approach, but it's actually an old approach at the same time. And that's what I think the share economy plays a really, really, really interesting role. Is the old principle of the Rockefellers, right? You should own nothing and control everything. And I think the new generation, Generation Z, they got that concept very well. They're not attached to ownership like the previous generation. And one of the simpler ways that I was able to crack the code on this and make a really decent money, as a matter of fact, I went from a truck driver to a millionaire in 4 years. It was utilizing and changing the notion of consumption and ownership when I launch a lot of properties. One of the main things that I do on real estate, I make money from real estate without owning the property. So right now we're running about 50 properties on Airbnb. And the good thing is all the properties, we rent the property long-term and make the spread and the difference between the long-term rental and the short-term rental. So we are able to create cash flow in over 60 properties in 7 different cities without owning a single property.
Okay, so let me back up and see if I understand you. You take a building, let's say a single-family house, and you lease it for 30 years, let's say. And then you lease it to somebody else for a 1 year. So if you're paying a dollar, you lease it for $2 a month. Did I hear that correct?
Well, yeah, that is correct. So basically what you probably learned that from your dad. Your dad probably learned that from your grandparents and so forth so on. That in order to make money from real estate, you have to own the damn thing, right? You have to sign a mortgage, 30-year mortgage, and you have to own it. You have to have a liability on your balance sheet. What I come in is I say, okay, you were working with the smart dad, rich dad, smart daddy strategy where you cash flow it. You buy a property, you take a mortgage on it, and you're going to rent it out, and you're going to make the difference between your mortgage and between your insurance and your taxes. You might going to make $300, $400, $500 cash flow on that property. And actually, it's a good strategy because somebody else is paying for your mortgage, right? I come in and said, okay, I'm the next guy where I'm going to rent the property from you, Don. I'm going to pay your mortgage. I'm going to allow you to make $300 to $400. But as a matter of fact, I'm going to make money between the spread of the long-term and the short-term. So perhaps I'm going to rent the property from you. For you, it's going to be very beneficial because nobody's going to take care of your property better than I am, because if your property is not in good condition, I'm not going to make money from it. The property has always to be pristine, and I'm going to actually rent that property for $100 a night. So let's say you have a one-bedroom apartment, for instance, that you're going to rent out for $1,000 a month. So I come in, I pay you the $1,000. I say, Don, you don't have to worry about your property. If anything goes wrong with it, I'll fix it. And it's going to cost me another $250 in utilities. So the total cost of that property is $1,250. And I turn around and I offer that property on the short-term industry for $100 a night. So potentially, I'm going to make $3,000 a month. I'll pay you your rent. It covers my utilities, and I'm actually going to make anywhere from $700 to $1,500 cash flow on that property that I don't even own.
Well, I understand that, and there are some big companies who are buying up single-family homes and renting them out, leasing them out to families. But are you leasing out rooms or are you leasing out homes? What are you leasing out?
So we have actually, it's you can actually do all of it. I have properties that we lease by rooms. I have properties that I lease the entire apartment, and I actually have luxury properties where it costs anywhere from $500 to $1,000 a night. And we are talking about $1 million, $2 million property that we cater to the luxury and upscale clientele. So it's definitely a room for any one of those entry level. And as a matter of fact, tying that up with the share economy, for instance, if you live in a property where you have a spare bedroom and you like to make extra cash or perhaps live for free, you can definitely lease that extra bedroom on Airbnb, VRBO, and some of those other sites. And that actually can bring you anywhere from $500 to $1,000 extra a month. And that's the power of the share economy.
We're talking with Marcus Jacober. Am I pronouncing it right, Jacober?
Yes, Jacober, yes.
Marcus Jacober. We're talking about the shared economy and his fairly unique approach to it. But Marcos, let's back up a little bit and let me see if I understand. You're renting rooms, you're renting apartments, and you're renting homes that you in turn have rented, leased. Am I hearing you correctly?
That's correct. So just so you know, we are like on a day number, I think day number, I'll say 51 of 2019, and up to this day, we have grossed about $250,000 in rentals in 50 days without owning a single property.
Well, that's really interesting. Where do you get people to know about your available properties?
Okay, so you guys can visit the website is lifehackswealth.com. Lifehackswealth.com.
Now, this is radio. Spell it out.
Okay, so it's lifehackswealth.com. Lifehackswealth.com. And you can learn about this strategy and also all the properties that we have available. Mainly, we list our properties on Airbnb. And the cool thing, Don, about the share economy is that most people don't realize it. When you're going to open your first business, or you want to switch it from being an employee and become an entrepreneur, 85% of the investment that you have to make in order to establish a business is from a website, is from marketing, is from systems that you're going to need in order to communicate with your guests or with your customers. You're going to need a back office systems to control, you know, the finances and all the stuff. And share economy comes to provide anybody that wants to venture into the entrepreneurship world. Share economy provides all of it, everything that you need. And actually, the barrier of entry, it's way, 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 way small than most people think. Let's talk about Airbnb for 1 second. And I'm not picking on Airbnb. There's definitely, like I said, hundreds of other platforms out there. But in order for me to create my short-term rental empire without owning any property, Airbnb provides me the website. Airbnb provides me the marketing. So every day we have a million people that goes on a website, on Airbnb website to rent properties. Airbnb provides me the messaging system that allows me to communicate with my guests. It provides me the calendar software. It provides me everything that I need to run my business and actually charges me only 3%. So the platforms of a share economy that's out there, one of the biggest advantages is that they take all the weight that entrepreneurs have to carry to start a business, right? And provides you all the platforms and systems that you need and charge you a small fee for it, which means all you have to do is just have the property. In 15 minutes, you can launch any property on an Airbnb website, and you can start making money right away.
It's fascinating. I'm going to go back to it, but let's talk about who are the people that rent your properties?
Who are the people that rent my properties? Okay, very interesting question. So when you think about hospitality, right? We think about tourism. That's the first thing that comes to mind. The same way that people are not taking cabs or taxi anymore, everybody's taking an Uber, or everybody is even use the Uber term, even though they're gonna get on the Lyft. The same thing is happening with the hospitality industry. When people are traveling, they don't look for hotels anymore. The first thing they look for homes for on Airbnb or any one of those short-term sites, mainly because the experience is different. I don't know if you remember when Uber came into play, Uber used to offer water, candy, phone chargers. It was a different experience and a different service. So hotels are in big trouble because this system and the Airbnbs and some vacation rental homes came to offer a different type of experience. So you have anybody from a business traveler to a big family that when they go to any destination, they rather stay in a home away from home kind of feeling than stay in a hotel. It doesn't matter how luxurious the hotel is. It's always the same experience. You have a room with a bed, a TV on the wall, and a bathroom, right? So there's no experience attached to it. So it's definitely growing. The way people are traveling, it's changing. And there's a huge potential when it comes to that platform alone, mainly because you are able to actually break the number one proposition that's making people fail when it comes to make a decent living and live the life of their dreams. And the proposition that most people are working is, I'm trading time for money. And every time you trade time for money, you have a limited factor because there's only enough time for you that you can produce hours and then you can work. It doesn't matter if you make $10 an hour or $1,000 an hour. Your gain and your potential ability to produce income is limited, right? When it comes to the share economy and a lot of those platforms out there, you are able to actually leverage yourself. And Warren Buffett says something very interesting. If you don't find a way to make money while you sleep, you're going to work until you die. So there's definitely, and that's why I'm so excited when I talk about the share economy, because share economy provides you all 85% what you need to launch a business. Share economy also kills the proposition for you to trade time for money, and also allows you to make money while you sleep. So it's amazing.
You know, I've been a correspondent all over the world, and I'm used to roughing it. Yet I reached a point in life where I use a Hyatt or a Marriott because I know A, they're safe, and B, they're consistent. I don't know what I'm renting if I go out and rent, even with a B&B, et cetera. It seems to me that you are appealing to a younger audience, not an older audience. Am I right on that?
Well, you were right in a sense because probably you never experienced an Airbnb or that type of accommodation, right? When it comes to share economy, and that has everything to do with Generation Z, do you know what is the biggest currency when it comes to share economy?
I don't. I'm here to learn from
okay.
you.
Amazing. So going forward, the biggest currency that we're going to have, it's not money, it's not dollar, it's not euro, it's not any type of exchange currency that carries value, it's reputation. So reputation is the new currency when it comes to share economy. So when you're looking and you're searching for an Airbnb in any one of the 192 countries, there's actually more than 4 million listings on Airbnb right now. Reputation is the biggest currency. So which means is if you're going to rent a place, you're going to read a bunch of reviews of people that already stayed on that place. And there's going to have a value of that reputation. When you come and you stay in one of my places, I'm actually going to write a reviews about you, what kind of guest you are, and you're also going to be carrying that currency, which is reputation. So the different experience is I don't like to go home with a bag full of dirty laundry, right? When I stay in a place, an Airbnb, I have a washer and dryers. I can do my own laundry. I don't have to go out and eat all the days. I can prepare my own food because there's a kitchen. Again, it's the home away from home feeling, right? You never have the feeling that you are in a hotel. In some cases, you actually is a better home away from home feeling because some of those properties offer you a better experience than you might have in your own home.
We're talking with Marcos Jacober. He's got a fascinating approach to the shared economy. Marcos, please, your website again for our listeners.
Okay, so my website is lifehackswealth.com. Life Hacks Wealth. You can follow us on Facebook. You can follow us on Instagram as well under the same name. And we also, you can also visit our YouTube channel, where right now I'm traveling across country and showing people my day-to-day operations, how you can actually build an empire, not only in the Airbnb, but how you can buy tax liens and tax deeds, how you can start investing, buying properties all over the United States with a $100 investment. So it's a pretty cool show.
Okay, let's talk a little bit. If I go out to rent a place, lease a place for to start my business with you, I've got to put up some money up front. Am I correct? Because the someone's going to demand 2 months' rent in advance or some such guarantee. Am I correct?
That's correct. So that's going to vary on the market. There's some markets that you can rent property with no deposit, but definitely the first month of rent is worth. And mainly the amount that you need to invest is actually what you're going to pay for rent and actually furnish, right? Furnish, because you're going to have to furnish the place. I'm now in a stage that we rent properties that's already fully furnished, and all we have to do is come up with the rent money, and boom, we are in business. As a matter of fact, I'm sitting in a house right now in Coconut Grove, Miami. It's a $1 million house. We rent this property for $5,000 a month. This property is fully furnished. It has a pool, a spa. It's a very upscale property. And get this, I signed the lease was Tuesday at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. I was only going to get the keys for the property on Wednesday, which was yesterday, I believe, around noon. As soon as I signed the contract, I went and launched that property on the Airbnb site. In less than 24 hours, I had about $3,500 worth of reservation. And I have even had the chance to get the keys of the property yet. That's how magical this thing is.
So, but if I'm working a franchise with you and I pick up two or three properties like that, I can put them on your site and you will help me sell them or lease them?
So actually, you're not going to put on my site. You're going to go to the Airbnb website. So Airbnb, let's say Uber. Uber is the largest transportation company in the world, and they don't own a single car. Is that correct?
Right. So,
Airbnb, I didn't
understand that. So you're saying what you're doing, pardon me, so Marco, so I can clear it up. So you're saying you help people identify how to do this, and then they put it up on B2B, and then hopefully
Airbnb.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. So actually, we're going to utilize Airbnb. So Airbnb is the platform. It's the largest. So Airbnb is the largest hotel company in the world, or hospitality company in the world, and they don't own a single property.
But don't you have to pass some sort of an inspection from Airbnb in order to be come up on?
No, actually, no. You only have to go through inspection if you want to get qualified for something that they call Airbnb Plus, which is it's only targeted to a luxury and high-level properties, right? So basically, you can rent from – there's people making money renting their couch on Airbnb, okay? You can actually rent your couch for $15 a night, okay? And actually, the story about Airbnb, it started just like that. It was a couple of friends in San Francisco that started offering air mattress and breakfast for people that were going to attend to a conference in San Francisco, and all the hotels were all booked. That's how the idea started.
Well, see, I'm learning something new every day. That's what I love about the program and people like yourselves, always teaching me something new.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, check it out. Once you stay in an Airbnb, especially if you travel with your family, you never want to stay in a hotel anymore.
What you have to understand, Marcos, my idea of roughing it is only having a shower at the Holiday Inn. My days of, you know, roughing it are over. I'm a lot older than you, but I appreciate what you're doing. And in effect, you're opening up Airbnb to people who would not necessarily have even thought of being in the business. Am I correct?
Yes. So actually what I do is I develop a training program called Airbnb the Boss, where if people want to crack into this business and start making money in the next 30 days, I can definitely help them out in the step 1, 2, 3, right? 1, 2, 5. It's actually 5 steps. That's one of the things that I do. Another thing that I do is I'm actually put my money where my mouth is. I'm actually out here launching properties. We actually launch anywhere from 5 to 8 properties on Airbnb every month. And like I said, it's only 51 days into 2019. We already made over almost $250,000 from Airbnb. And our goal into the end of 2019 in December, we want to hit about $400,000 a month in revenue just from Airbnb properties without owning a single property.
Okay, Marcus, we're coming, unfortunately, to the end of this time. I said it would move quickly. Your website for people who want to learn more about your help and your website, just your website, so for one more, last time.
Okay. So it's Life Hacks Wealth, LifeHacksWealth.com. And the same name for Facebook and Instagram and YouTube.
Well, a link to that website will be on 2SB Digest, Small Business Digest, tonight. Marcos, thank you so much for being with us. It's been a absolutely fascinating half hour for me, and I hope for our audience as well. Thank you.
No, Don, I really appreciate your initiative to actually open up this space for people to learn more about business and to learn different ways to make money. Thank you very much for having me.
That's what this show's all about, and thank you.
I appreciate it.
One, Tony Soprano, the famed fictional crime boss who grew up in the Ironbound section of Newark, New Jersey, turned to a psychologist to resolve some of his conflicted emotions. I grew up in the Ironbound section of Newark at the same time as depicted in the forthcoming movie prequel to the television Soprano saga. In the highly successful television series, Tony Soprano was a man born to the mob, yet questioning his birthright, the rules he lived by, and the people he associated with. Tony Soprano was not alone, and my book, Frankie, If You Get Hurt, I'll Kill You, talks about those changes and the people they affected, myself included, and the fictional Tony Soprano. The period 1950 to 1965 was the time of major changes hitting Tony Soprano in fiction and my neighbors in real life. He, like many of my neighbors, felt the strain of an evolving Italian-American heritage. Tony Soprano and my generation were being torn from their roots, rendered from the comfort of their familiar with changing rules and mores. The family, long a center of his life, was unraveling. Recall, his mother, actually, Tony Soprano's mother, actually ordered his liquidation. The mob to which Tony Soprano was born to was morphing in ways he neither understood nor wanted. My book, Frankie, If You Get Hurt, I'll Kill You, explores these changes by leading the reader through the labyrinth of channels swept away for most of us of Tony Soprano's generation. Tony Soprano is fiction. His experiences were not. Return with me to those times where individuals did things differently there and needed to adapt to changes without comprehending the exact nature of those demands. Certainly, Tony Soprano did did not quite understand. Neither did I, nor others of our generation. I provide insight in Frankie, if you get hurt, I'll kill you, because my father was for many years the chief launderer of their shirts and the pressing. My mother had a lifetime friendship with the mob boss, and I covered them for the Newark News. The book is Frankie, If You Get Hurt, I'll Kill You, and available soon here and at your favorite bookstore. I am Don Mazzella. The program is Small Business Digest, and our next guest is Daniel Elliott. He himself has a fascinating background, and I know we want to hear about his organization and what it does. Dan, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Well, as we start every guest, tell us a little bit about yourself first, then a little bit about your organization, and then finally a website where our listeners can go.
Sure. So I'm director of small business education at the National Cybersecurity Alliance. And so, you know, my background, prior to joining the National Cybersecurity Alliance, I worked with small businesses in the state of Delaware, helping them start and scale. And so we realized quite early on that small businesses needed cybersecurity education awareness, which then I developed a statewide program for Delaware, which led me into the National Cybersecurity Alliance, now where I run a national program supporting small businesses with cybersecurity education awareness. And the umbrella organization over my efforts is the National Cybersecurity Alliance. And we're a nonprofit organization devoted to cybersecurity education awareness. We co-lead October's National Cybersecurity Awareness Month each year. We lead Data Privacy Day for North America and a bunch of other focused efforts to support all stakeholders across the country when it comes to cybersecurity. And our website is www.staysafeonline.org.
Well, could you spell it out, this being radio?
Sure. It's staysafeonline.org.
Okay. So essentially we're talking cybersecurity. Am I correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Probably one of the most important issues facing small business today, in our opinion, and I don't know how you feel about it.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, small businesses are a huge target, and they need to realize they have a responsibility to protect business, employee, and customer data, and it can't be an afterthought. Small businesses are a huge target because cyber criminals know that small businesses are an easier target than larger corporations. They don't have the large IT budgets, the massive legal teams, the PR teams, et cetera. And they're portals into much larger targets like the federal government or a larger organization. And so they're heavily targeted by cyber criminals.
Well, let's take some of these issues one by one. You know, for the past year and a half, this program has been hammering away at this issue because we know it is so important and how vulnerable small businesses are. What are some of the, I guess my first question are, what are some of the basic things small businesses should do to prevent cyber attacks?
Sure. I guess off the record. So I was informed this would be specifically about cybersecurity for small business during tax time. I mean, I can go in any direction, but should I focus on tax season specifically, or should I talk in more general terms?
Wherever you want to go with it. Start with tech, but also consider our audience is hungry for information on this subject because it consistently comes up in our surveys as an issue that they want more information on. The more you give us, the happier we'll be.
Sure, great. You know, I think You know, in general terms, you know, there are a lot of quick wins small businesses can do in order to make themselves more secure. For one, make sure that they are updating the software on their devices, whether it's their handheld devices or their computers. This is a free or often cheap method, and it includes also web-based services like their many small businesses use WordPress or other hostings for their websites, and so making sure that they're updating all the software because those are updating such security patches. They also need to have a plan in place, really, as far as when it comes to if an incident happens, right? Who do they turn to? What do they do? They don't want to be creating a plan at the moment that there's a cybersecurity breach or incident. And, you know, I also want to say, you know, they need to make sure that they do a data deep dive, and it really helps even preparing for tax season, which is right now. But determining what information that they handle or store out of business necessity, and then safely dispose of any unnecessary data. And keeping in mind that this goes for paper documents too, they also need to make sure that they're encrypting data, both in transit, so as it's moving, and also as it's resting. And a lot of these are free efforts again. But what I will also add is that small businesses need to think about access control. I know from experience, a lot of small businesses give access to as many employees as possible, to as much data as possible. And what we actually want to move towards is kind of the principle of least privilege, where it enforces minimal user privileges on networks based on the user's jobs and necessity. So in a nutshell, they shouldn't be accessing data they don't need unless it's for their particular responsibilities.
Keep going. You're on a roll.
Okay. You know, I think all of what I'm saying would be moot if small businesses don't couple it with regular staff training. And ramping up to tax season in particular, with this being this time of year, would be a proper time to train all HR and payroll staff on tips for identifying W-2 or other tax scams. And also not only thinking about training existing staff, but thinking about how we're training new staff, whether that's temporary staff, contractors, et cetera. How do we train them when we onboard them? And then also, what are our processes when we offboard them for removing access and making sure that they're not going to be a threat or a potential threat to our organization once they leave? So those are a few tips. Another great free step that small businesses can take is enable two-factor authentication, right? So that's and many security settings aren't defaulted when you buy a new technology or you sign up for a new service or you sign up for a new social media account, whatever it is. So we just have to go into our privacy settings and enable stricter security settings and privacy settings. And so when they do that, and I encourage all small businesses check out the security and privacy settings of every account they have to make sure they're enabling two-factor authentication, which adds another step to someone accessing your accounts who shouldn't be accessing them.
Well, that's really fascinating. Let's talk a little bit of tech. What are some of the recommendations you make to people and on the tech side, can you be a little bit more specific?
Well, you know, we don't promote products or services, particularly from NCSA's perspective, but I will say as far as tech goes, you know, we encourage small businesses, if they have many passwords that they need to be protecting, to employ password managers. And there are many great consumer reports and blogs out there that compare the different technologies. We also want to make sure that they're employing firewalls and antivirus and anti-malware software and all their devices. Now, cybersecurity is kind of three major components, right? It's people. Are we teaching people good behaviors, maybe how to identify malicious emails or a sketchy call? Processes. Are we employing sound policies and procedures in our organization that will hopefully minimize threats? And then lastly, it's technology, right? Because if we have solid people and processes, I will say if we have a bunch of bad people and processes or untrained people and no processes, then it doesn't matter what technology you throw at it, it won't be effective. And so it really comes down to making sure that we employ strong people in an organization who are equipped with the capabilities and the resources to recognize threats and processes to minimize the ability for them to make a mistake. And then those technologies that I mentioned, which can help protect and detect when something goes wrong.
We are talking with Dan Elliott. Your website again, Dan, for people to get, I'm sure there's an awful lot of information on the website. So please, will you give it to us again?
Sure. It is staysafeonline.org. That's STAYSAFEONLINE.org.
Well, you sponsor what I think is one of the most important national months, cybersecurity. What have you seen in terms of trends that you would want like to pass on to our audience in terms of new threats or old threats that are new again? Have you seen some things recently that you think should be highlighted?
Well, you know, email threats have been the easiest way for cyber criminals to access small business and big businesses' information, and that still remains the biggest threat. And so what I will say is, you know, when it comes to small businesses, they really need to make sure that they're training their employees on how to identify malicious emails, or training themselves on how to identify malicious emails, because that's not going away anytime soon, because it makes money for cyber criminals and it's effective, very effective. Another trend that we've been seeing, and it harkens back to what I mentioned earlier about updating your software. People like to click postpone and they're not updating their software. Individuals also are still having trouble with making secure passwords and passphrases. And so making sure that, you know, a lot of it's not high tech, right? I mean, it's boiling it back down to the basics. If we don't follow some of the basics, we're never going to be more secure. And so updating our software, making sure that we identify malicious emails, and that we know the warning signs of a malicious email, and then having some of our passwords and making them stricter, like enabling two-factor authentication, so it's harder to compromise those. Some of those basics, this past October was the 15th year for National Cybersecurity Awareness Month, and we're still seeing some of these basic issues coming out, and so we want to make sure that people are, it's in their face continually.
You're so right. I was shocked the other day to find out that someone I know still uses password as their secret user, you know, their passcode word. I was shocked.
Sure, and it was probably written down on a post-it note and put under their keyboard as well.
it said, but true, you know, because of the nature of our work, we get an awful lot of strange emails. And for us, it's a constant battle here at this radio station to decide which ones we will open and which ones we will ignore. And it's a frightening game for us, simply because there are legitimate reasons. People sense the stuff that we don't know about. Twice we've had very vicious attacks and had to pull down everything. So we're very aware of that, of the security. But we were surprised that 23% of the people we surveyed this January said that they had no extraordinary cybersecurity. And I was just shocked by the number.
Yeah. It is shocking. And, you know, unfortunately, a lot of people say, well, I'm not a technology expert, and so I can't kind of develop a cybersecurity plan, or I don't know where to start. And if they do have a data breach, that doesn't stand up in a court of law. And so they have to take cybersecurity seriously. They have to understand that they are a target, and they have to take steps to protect the data. They have a responsibility, an ethical and legal responsibility to protect the data that they're collecting, storing, transmitting, creating, et cetera. And that's a part of running a business today.
Well, that's very true. Well, a company has a data breach, what should they be doing?
Well, if they have a data breach, they need to be reaching out to their legal counsel, most definitely, because what they have to comply with, it depends on where the customers are, you know, who the customers are, right, that are compromised. If they are customers who are residents of Europe, then they have to comply with GDPR. If they're customers, maybe the company's based out of California, but if it's a customer based out of Idaho, then they have to comply with Idaho's data breach notification law. And so that's why it's important that they, if there is a legitimate data breach, that they understand the legal requirements for the customers in all the different states that are impacted. And every state has a different data breach notification law. And so if nothing else encourages small businesses to take cybersecurity seriously, it's the thought of trying to comply with 50 different states' data breach notification laws on top of international laws, on top of paying lawyers. And so that's why it's so critical. You know, definitely reaching out to their local legal authorities as well. Federal Bureau of Investigation is a great place to start, in addition to the legal authorities and their insurance companies. And what I will say is that, you know, general liability often does not cover cybersecurity breach. And so small businesses need to look at their coverage and make sure that they are covered in some form or fashion for a breach.
Couldn't agree with you more. We have just a few minutes left. So what I would love to do, Dan, is for you to kind of summarize everything we've talked beforehand and repeat for our audience, because it's so important what you're saying.
Sure. You know, I think, you know, small businesses, as I said, have to take cybersecurity seriously, and they have a responsibility, both legally and ethically, to protect the data that they're collecting, creating, storing, and transmitting. And, you know, some of the biggest threats that are facing them are still, you know, email threats and business email compromise. And particularly during tax time, it's W-2 scams and or bogus emails from the IRS, you know, quote-unquote IRS. And so making sure that they're training their staff and training themselves, and in extension, training their families, their mothers, the fathers, the children, on how to identify malicious emails, and building in processes for how to handle requests for sensitive information. Because it is a people and a process and a technology issue. We often just default to cybersecurity as a technology issue, and it's not. It's people and processes and technology. And so, you know, it boils down to the basics of protecting ourselves, identifying malicious emails, updating our software, having strong authentication with strong passwords and two-factor authentication. A lot of these small businesses can do for free. And as they scale their business and grow their business, of course, they need more sophisticated information security infrastructure built into the organization. But these are some basics that they can start with right now. And individuals can learn more about all the resources we have at staysafeonline.org, which is staysafeonline.org. And we have a great new resource on our website about tech scams, because those are rampant right now. And they're not just digital tech scams. They're, you know, in-person tech scams and telephone tech scams. And so making sure that they're aware of the threats that are facing them right now, which are incredibly important.
Could not agree with you more. But we still have a few minutes left. You mentioned the IRS scams. Could you kind of give us a taste of some of those things?
Yeah, oh, definitely. So, you know, right now one of the most significant this time of year are W-2 scams, right? And these come in a few different forms, but a common form is a phishing email to an HR or payroll professional where the criminal masks himself or herself as an executive in the organization, and they request W-2s. And so because the employees think they're corresponding with an executive, they often act swiftly, and it can take weeks or months or years for someone to even realize that data theft has even occurred. And so companies need to have policies and procedures in place for handling the transfer of sensitive information, such as having secondary verification. So if, quote unquote, the boss emails and says, send me those W-2s right now, there's a secondary verification of a phone call saying, did you actually request that, or an in-person verification. You know, there are often people get a lot of emails right now from quote unquote IRS. It's cyber criminals sending emails and impersonating the IRS requesting money or requesting the individual to create an account and submit sensitive information. And people need to be aware, both general consumers and businesses, that the IRS does not initiate taxpayer communication through email. They're not going to email requesting you send money or telling you the feds are going to come and knock on your door. That should be flagged as bogus. And, you know, tax time scams aren't just during tax time, right? So, for instance, there are scams throughout the year when there are natural disasters and people take advantage of individuals wanting to make tax deferred contributions to assist with the recovery. And many scammers set up sham charitable or sham charities and take advantage of those individuals trying to contribute. And so tax season, there are a lot of email-based scams, but it's also all throughout the year. And I'll say that the IRS puts together what's called the Dirty Dozen. It's a running list of scams. And if you just Google IRS Dirty Dozen, it'll show you all the different tax season scams that the IRS has found, and kind of they provide descriptions of each. But what I want to make sure people take away from this is, one, realize there's a heightened threat during tax season when it comes to email compromise and threat, but also, you know who your tax preparer is and understand what steps they are taking to your sensitive data. That's incredibly important as well.
Really terrific. Dan, your website one more time for our audience.
Sure. It is staysafeonline.org, staysafeonline.org.
A link to that website will be on Small Business Digest tonight. Our website is the number 2 SB Digest. We've been hearing from Dan Elliott, and he's given us a lot of food for thought. And this program has been particularly over the years sensitive to how critical cybersecurity is. And we thank Dan and his group for taking a leading role. Dan, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Wine, the Tony Soprano, the famed fictional crime boss who grew up in the Ironbound section of Newark, New Jersey, turned to a psychologist to resolve some of his conflicted emotions? I grew up in the Ironbound section of Newark at the same time as depicted in the forthcoming movie prequel to the television Soprano saga. In the highly successful television series, Tony Soprano was a man born to the mob, yet questioning his birthright, the rules he lived by, and the people he associated with. Tony Soprano was not alone, and my book, Frankie, If You Get Hurt, I'll Kill You, talks about those changes and the people they affected, myself included, and the fictional Tony Soprano. The period 1950 to 1965 was the time of major changes hitting Tony Soprano in fiction and my neighbors in real life. He, like many of my neighbors, felt the strain of an evolving Italian-American heritage. Tony Soprano and my generation were being torn from their roots, rendered from the comfort of their familiar with changing rules and mores. The family, long a center of his life, was unraveling. Recall, his mother, actually, Tony Soprano's mother, actually ordered his liquidation. The mob to which Tony Soprano was born to was morphing in ways he neither understood nor wanted. My book, Frankie, If You Get Hurt, I'll Kill You, explores these changes by leading the reader through the labyrinth of channels swept away for most of us of Tony Soprano's generation. Tony Soprano is fiction. His experiences were not. Return with me to those times where individuals did things differently there and needed to adapt to changes without comprehending the exact nature of those demands. Certainly, Tony Soprano did not quite understand. Neither did I, nor others of our generation. I provide insight in Frankie, If You Get Hurt, I'll Kill You, because my father was for many years the chief launderer of their shirts and the pressing. My mother had a lifetime friendship with their mob boss, and I covered them for the Newark News. The book is Frankie, If You Get Hurt, I'll Kill You, and available soon here and at your favorite bookstore. You have been listening to Small Business Digest. Our website is the number 2 SB Digest. Go there to hear this and all past and future shows. And tell us of a guest you would like to hear on this program. Remember, this show is about helping our audience improve profit. I'm Don Mazzella, and thank you.